Hi, everybody. My name is Larsine. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And my recovery date in Al-Anon is June the 6th, 1981. And I am very, very grateful for that. And I want to thank Chris for picking us up at the airport. And the reason my husband doesn't say much is he doesn't get too much of a chance with her and I yakking in the front seat. So I think he was enjoying the company of a nice, quiet dog that just wanted to be petted. But we've had a great time here. I can't thank you enough for hospitality and Harlan and the committee for the invitation to get to be here. I love the Pacific Northwest. It's so beautiful up here. I absolutely love it up here and the trees. I'm a tree person, and we're really enjoying it. Your lineup of speakers is phenomenal, and I know all of them, and they're good friends, and they're really terrific people. I mean, yeah, you come up here and you can learn how to speak, but I know these people to be really good people as well, and Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, and how grateful I am for that. And I have to give a special shout out, you know, Nell is just really so special to me. 53 years in Al-Anon is a big frickin' deal, all right? I don't care who you are or what you're thinking. It's frickin' big. And she is such a wonderful example. I mean, just, I have been in Al-Anon long enough that I have had the privilege to chair two really large conferences in the Al-Anon portion of it, and both times Nell was my speaker, and that's how much we adore her and love her. And you want to talk about someone who is the epitome of what everybody wants to be when they grow up in Al-Anon. It is Nell. So I am so honored to be on this same ticket with you. I can't even begin to say. But enough about Nell. Because I hang out with alcoholics enough to know, yeah, it is all about me. And sometimes it's a little bit tough to be an Al-Anon speaker at an AA conference. I liken it to being the corpse at an Irish wake. Nobody expects you to say much, but they can't have the party without you, you know? So you're like the token deal, you know? I know Nell knows what I'm talking about. And you come to these conferences, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, and then in little tiny print it says, with Al-Anon participation, you know? And I think, yeah, when alcoholics are in jail, they want Al-Anon participation, then, boy, then it's a lot bigger deal, isn't it? You know, so... But it is an honor and a privilege to get to be here, and I'm so grateful that, you know, that you do have Al-Anon on your program. You know, it's the big book talks a lot about the family afterwards, the chapter to the wives. All the fun stuff is in the family afterwards, like I say, an honor and a privilege to get to be a part of it, and I thank you so much for including Al-Anon in it. It is a family disease, and I learn a lot from Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. We can't all be alcoholics, okay? Some of us have to hold the world together till you guys get your act together to take your rightful place as the guru of the universe, but we're doing the best we can as well, and it's fun. It's just fun. I'm so grateful that when I started coming to Al-Anon, my husband was in a group of Alcoholics Anonymous that was so inclusive of family. You know, they had the AA meetings, but there was always picnics and birthdays and potlucks, you know, and no matter what was going on, after the meeting, everybody would meet for coffee and ice cream and, you know, and everybody was included. And how grateful I am that we grew up in that kind of a group. That's the only AA and Al-Anon that I know, and I am so grateful for that, and that Alcoholics Anonymous embraced, you know, me so well. When my husband first got sober, I was like paranoid to go to AA with him. I don't know why, but I was really freaked out that they would think I was an alcoholic. It just really freaked me out. So I said to my husband one day, how are they going to know that I'm not an alcoholic? And he's going, don't worry, they'll know. And I thought that was a compliment, but little did I know, and apparently they always did know. But anyway, I'm just going to tell a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me today. I'm the oldest of four kids. My dad's a master sergeant in the Army. So that means being the oldest, I've always had some kind of rank. I like rank. I like a title. I like buildings that have words like headquarters on them and stuff like that. I'm just attracted to that. My husband jokes that I came out of the womb carrying a clipboard and wearing an armband, and he's not too far off the mark. When I was in school, I was always cafeteria monitor, playground monitor, you know, room monitor. Why? Because the teacher knew if she left and she left me in charge and anybody did anything wrong, I would write down their name and they would be reported. supported. It's just a gift I have. I don't know what else to tell you. You know, you have to embrace the gifts that God gives you, you know, and I've just always been like that. I'm a rule person. I grew up in the military. There's a lot of rules and regulations about it. My dad raised us just like he took care of his troops in the Army. We had little Army bunk beds. We had foot lockers at the end of our beds where our gear was stored. We had Army blankets on our beds. My dad flipped quarters on our bed. We had room inspection. We stood at attention, saluted him at the end. He went through our foot lockers, bounced quarters, and then patted us on the head, saluted us. You know, and I'm talking 3, 4, 5 years old. I've been doing this stuff. You know, when Butch and I first got married, he couldn't even get out of the bed because the sheets were so tight. He was just like, don't you dare move either, buddy, you know, and it was just what I grew up in, and I didn't know there was anything wrong with that. It's just a lot of discipline, and what I've really come to learn about myself is that I like that. I like rules and regulations. I like knowing what you want. I like knowing how you like to have it. I love instructions. I love things that are written down. For me, it's part of who I am and what I was raised with. You know, I am just hardwired for all of that stuff. It's organization for me, and I like it. I always have a purse that has lots of compartments. I like lots of compartments because keys go here, phone goes here, wallet goes here. So when no matter what happens, I am ready and instantly prepared for it. And again, there is some sort of comfort that goes with that for me. And I know that about myself, and I'm grateful to Al-Anon that I can accept that about myself. When I first started coming to Al-Anon, I thought it was that you were supposed to change everything that there was about you. What I've really come to learn in Al-Anon is Al-Anon doesn't want you to change who you are. It just wants you to be the person God meant you to be in the first place. You know, and the family disease of alcoholism has a tendency to rob us of that. You know, but I am this like or super organized person. It's, again, a gift I have. I have, you know, I just like things where they go so I can find them. And, you know, and even 33 years into the deal, you know, I it's not a guarantee, you know, that things are going to go the way you want all the time. I was one time about a year and a half ago or something, I'm at the airport and one of my flights got canceled and they kept changing the gate and moving me here and moving me there. And I don't like it because, by God, you knew I was coming. I booked this ticket like 6 months ago. This is not working for me. And I'm getting more and more flustered. And I'm coming back from a conference where I've been very serene and wonderful, right? But now I'm freaking out. So finally I get on the freaking airplane, I'm sitting there and I'm talking to my husband and I'm looking through my purse to make sure everything's in the proper location and my cell phone's not there. Oh my God, I left my cell phone outside. He's like, what are you talking to me on, you know? Never mind, hang up the phone. Here we go. This is why it's so important for me to be here, because it's a day at a time, every single solitary day. There's no cross in the finish line, none of that. And I don't want there to be either. I don't want to know everything, and I thought I had to know everything. And now it's so unimportant to me. You know, I know the important things that we learn here that the other speakers have spoken about that you're going to hear all throughout the weekend. It's about living in the present, right here, right now, unconditional love. You know, it's about being happy, joyous, and free. And how grateful I am for that today. How very, very grateful. But anyway, I got this military dad, and my dad's an alcoholic. Now, I have no idea my dad's an alcoholic because my dad's been drinking since I can ever remember. You don't get a book that says this is what a dad is supposed to do or not do. You know, my dad's a master sergeant, and there's a lot of drinking in the Army, and there was a lot of moms walking around with broken arms and black eyes, and it's just, to me, growing up, that's just the way that it is. It's the way life is supposed to be, because this is what I see, and I see it going on all around me. Dads drink, and they drink a lot. Except when my dad drank, and he drank a lot. My dad's a mean guy. My dad's a mean guy sober, so when he drinks, he even gets meaner. It's just the way that it is with him, but I have absolutely no idea. I used to have a hard time because as a little kid, I would try to figure out why someone would go to the trouble to marry someone, have kids, and then make them all feel bad about who they were. You know, I could never quite put my finger on what that was all about, but I had no idea that it was anything to do with drinking. Beer was always been there. You know, my dad he drank breakfast beer. You know, it was just an all-day event with him, and it would get progressively worse as the day went on. And again, you know, and what I call it is because as a little kid and you grow up in an alcoholic home, you know, if in my experience, the first thing that goes out the door is any form of verbal communication whatsoever, you know, and so my mom would like communicate to us facially. And if you've ever grown up in an alcoholic home, you know what I'm talking about, because we'd be at dinner and my mom could tell my dad was ready to have one of his alcoholic explosions, but she could never say to us kids, okay, nobody talk, nobody do anything, your dad's going to blow. So my mom would sit at the dinner table and just look at us, you know, and You know, we get that kind of stuff. And that's not an epileptic fit, boy. That's my mom. And you know what that means. That means look down at your plate. Do not look up. Be quiet. But if you have an alcoholic that's going to explode, nothing is going to stop that from happening. And sure enough, there'd be some minor infraction, some minor violation. Drag a knife across a plate, or your pee would roll off a plate, or you'd spill some milk, and my dad would go ballistic. And dinner would go flying, you know, and everybody would get a whooping and a beating, and we'd have to go to bed. It could be 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Everybody's got to go to bed. My mom, the kids, the dog. It's just the way it goes down in our house. You know, and then the next morning you get up the courage to go in the kitchen before you got to go to school that morning. And there's my dad drinking his breakfast beer. And you get up and it's just, so you walk in there and my dad's just like, good morning, what do you want for breakfast? And it's never, gee whiz, what was that about last night, Dad? Gee whiz, how come you had to hit everybody? How come you had to break everything? You know, but you just, you know, but it would just be, you know, one more time you think today is going to be different. And that's just, you know, and it's just typical behavior in an alcoholic home, just absolutely typical behavior. And I know that now. And what my sponsor taught me, you know, my sponsor Carol now, is this ordinary behavior in an alcoholic home. And that's such a gift to me, you know, because it being ordinary behavior takes the power out of it. It just takes the power out of it. And I was really, really grateful to know that. Of course, I didn't know that at the time. You know, my dad is just this really angry person. And all I remember, my first emotion as a child, my very first memory is fear. Fear of my dad. My very first thing I can ever remember, and the experience and the yelling and the screaming and everything went on. That's my first remembrance of my life on this planet. You know, but that's the effect, and that's the disease, the family disease of alcoholism. But I don't know any of that's going on. I just know this is the big scary guy I have to be afraid of. But yet I'm living in this house all the time, day after day after day. And again, you know, my dad, I have no idea what all of that stuff was all about for him. You know, I got to find out later on that both of his parents were alcoholic. You know, his dad froze to death in a car, and then his mother, you know, they found her dead in her apartment, cirrhosis of the liver. You know, but I don't know any of that. My dad doesn't tell me any of that. You know, it's just the typical alcoholic stuff that's just going on over and over and over again. And it was just not a fun place to be. Not a fun place to be. And like I said, my dad's this master sergeant. He's a very intimidating guy to begin with. You know, and then you just, and then, the, you know, like I say, the drunker he gets, the angrier he gets for a lot of reasons, I suppose. But I never understood it. And I used to hear alcoholics talk about how they would drink and maybe, you know, 10 minutes into it or whatever, they would drink for that, you know, 2 minutes of just feeling okay. You know, and I never even got to see that 2 minutes in my dad of feeling okay. That's just how bad he was already out of the gate. And I wish I would have got to see him at least have 2 minutes apiece. But he was a man I know today that was horribly tormented, but I didn't know it then. Like I say, just this horrific house growing up in this, and my dad very much disliked having girl children. I mean, that was a real shame for him, you know, and he had 3 girls in a row, so he was very angry about that, and he always made us feel really, really bad about being girls. And again, what I know today, going to Al-Anon and going to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, is I just got a lot of misinformation from a man who had a lot of misinformation. And that's all there is to that. I don't need to give it any more power than that. But as a kid, I could never ask questions, you know, so, but I'm a person, I want answers. Information's really a big deal for me, you know, and if I can't ask questions, then what I learned to do as a little kid is just figure it out, you know, and what I know it is today is just freaking information from nowhere, because I just think crap up all the time, just floating up here. I try and look at what's going on and make some kind of a logical, you know, thing of piecing together, but usually there are big pieces of information missing, but I just take this little bit that I glob and this little bit, and somehow I meld it all together, and it lands here, becomes fact for me, and I act upon it. You know, and I am hardwired to think that way. I can meet you, and in 30 seconds or so, I pretty much got you pegged. You know, and again, and who does that disservice anybody more than me? You know, but again, I've been hardwired to think this way all the time. That's why Al-Anon is so important to me. Live and let live. If I'm doing the best I can, why don't I think that you're not doing the best that you can? You know, those are the gifts that we get to learn here. So anyway, I grew up in this alcoholic home, and I need to let you know, my dad ended up, he died when he was 55 years old. He died to the disease that they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, total insanity and death. I can't even tell you the last words my father said to me. They were so vile and so vulgar, I wouldn't even begin to repeat them from this podium. And I always say the last words my father said, and when in reality, what I know, it's the last words my father's alcoholism said. Because I'm here to tell you, that person in that bed that day, there was no human being in there at all. It was just the vile, evil, ugly disease of alcoholism. It chewed him up so bad, there was nothing else left. I don't think he weighed 120 pounds, and my dad was over 6 foot tall. And but, of course, I did not know that at that time. And I had started coming to Al-Anon just before my dad died. He died Friday, October the 13th, because my dad would pick Friday the 13th to die on. It was his kind of day. And and that was in 81, and I had started coming to Al-Anon in June of 81. So June to October, I was only in Al-Anon 3-4 months, not even close to loving and kind by any stretch of the imagination. You know, and when my dad died, my mom had long since divorced him, and being the oldest kid, I was responsible. You know, I had his power of attorney and all of that stuff for his health directives and all that. And my sisters and I are out in the waiting room, and they come out and they tell us my dad's dead. And I'd like to tell you it was a very sad moment for our family, but it wasn't. My sisters and I were like, ding dong, the witch is dead, da da da. You know, and I don't tell you the story because I'm proud of it. I tell you the story that this is where this family disease of alcoholism will take you, that you will be glad to have someone dead. Just because you think it's over, the reign of terror was over. Because my dad was always going to kill you, he was always going to do that. And we took some pretty bad beatings off of him as well. But, you know, but the verbal abuse was the worst thing. They're always the worst thing. You know, and if you've ever had a drunk dad show up at a school function when you're getting an award, I'm here to tell you that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is just not reserved for the alcoholic. And so you learn early on, you don't tell them nothing's going on ever, ever. You know, and you don't bring friends home from school anymore, you know, because you never know who's going to be there and what's going to happen and how humiliated and embarrassed you're going to be because of this person's behavior. You know, and so all I grew to do was hate the person. And see, what happened when my dad died is I really believed, even just but a few short months into Al-Anon, I really believed that the reign of terror was over. It was over. But what my sisters and I didn't know was that the alcoholic died that day, but the family disease of alcoholism was very much alive and living well in me and my sisters and our family. You know, and I'm here to tell you, I hate it when people say my qualifier. You know, somebody, you know, who's the alcoholic in your life? Fine. But I tell you who qualifies me for my seat in Al-Anon is me. My behavior, my reaction, my response. It's not on what somebody else is doing. My dad triggered it, but it was alive and well. When he was gone, we didn't even need him anymore to carry on that behavior. Blaming. You know, and that's another thing growing up with. It's got to be somebody's fault. Trying to figure out why. All those things that do nothing but hinder me and keep me from having a happy and joyous and free life. And so anyway, my dad had died, and I remember it didn't seem to matter, you know. I did all the work, boy. I'm a joiner, and I do what you're supposed to do, and I'm working the steps and doing all the stuff with my sponsor. But it seemed like I was, you know, several months into it, and it didn't seem, my dad had been gone for a little while, but no matter what, something would trigger something, somebody would say something, and I would think about these experiences that happened to me as a kid, and how my dad would yell and make us feel bad about whatever, and I'd get so angry all over again, and I'd done a fourth and a fifth, and, you know, was going through the step process with my sponsor on this, but I would get really pissy about it, and I don't know how you guys are, but when I'm really pissy and angry, I like to take it home and share it with my family and my children and my husband and the people I love and care about the most, because we should all experience this, you know, and if you can get the neighbors involved, all the more power to you, and I wasn't happy about that. That's not what I wanted to have happening. And I remember talking with my sponsor about it one time. And, you know, and she said, you know, Larcine, yep, Al-Anon isn't about problems. You know, Al-Anon is about a solution. And we have to find a solution that's going to work for you. And I'm going to give you an assignment. You're not going to like it. And she always said, you're going to give you an assignment. You're not going to like it. Because I have never liked one little weenie thing they've ever told me to do in Al-Anon. Because the answers here are so simple. You know, and so therefore I discard them right away because there cannot be such a simple answer to such huge problems that I have. You know, my dad hit me. My dad made me feel bad about being a girl. There's a lot of complex things going on here that just let go and let God is not going to work for me, okay? Just not going to happen. And I remember her telling me, I'm going to give you this an assignment. You're not going to like it. And the assignment she gave me was that I had to go home and I had to think about a good thing my dad had done for me. And how I am affected by the family disease of alcoholism is that there's no such thing. because what I know about how I'm affected by the family disease of alcoholism is it never wants me to see anything good, ever. That's the family disease of alcoholism. It wants you to live in despair. It wants you to live in the darkness. It wants you to live in the past, real big to live in the past. But one thing I learned right out of the gate when I first started coming to Al-Anon that I am so, so grateful for is for whatever reason at those first meetings I was at, I heard you had to be willing. Because how can you possibly expect anything to be different if you're not willing to do something different? So I've always had willingness, and that to me is God's grace. That's God, what God's grace was for me. Now, it's only been this much willingness, but this program is so powerful. I'm here to tell you only need that much to start out with. And I don't know how long it took me, a week or two. And I remember that my dad taught me how to drive. And if you're going to live in Southern California and marry an alcoholic of your own, it's just a skill you got to have, okay? If you're going to track that sucker down anyway. Because I'm talking about tracking down alcoholics way before cell phones and GPS crap and all that stuff. I'm talking about you had to get in the car and go find them with nothing more than information from nowhere. I was good at it. Because they don't leave a lot of hints either, okay? They're not hint leavers when they're hiding out. And especially when they're in blackouts, because they don't even know where they are. So it's a really complicated thing for us, these seekers of those that don't want to be sought. But anyway, he taught me how to drive. And I remember going to my sponsor thinking, she is not going to like this answer at all, you know, but that's her problem, right? She gave me an assignment, and I'm going to her with it. And my first sponsor, Jeannie, and I had my first sponsor until she passed away. She's just this most fabulous, wonderful woman. When they talked about a sponsor's passing away, I know how much that affected me, and I can never say enough good things about her because she was always such a wonderful person, though I never thought so, especially in the beginning, because she's a clapper, which just irritates the bejeebies out of me, give us like this kind of clapper. You know, so anytime I would do any little weeny thing, you know, which is like kindergarten to me, So I go up to her, and Jeannie, I thought up a good thing my dad did for me. We get clapping right away. Yay, 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 yay. And so I tell her, you know, he taught me how to drive. I think I'm going to be in trouble. No, now she's jumping up and down and clapping. Woohoo, woohoo. You know, because what I didn't know, because I was a rookie, was that when a sponsor gives you an assignment, there's going to be part two. But I didn't know that at the time. I thought I just had to do part one, and I was done. Now part two is now, Larsine, whenever you think about that stuff your dad did, whenever you think how he hit you, whenever you think how you made him feel bad about being a girl, whatever it was, whatever creepy thought creeps into your mind, I just want you to take that negative emotion and replace it with this positive one. You know, another thing, your dad died with all of his children being glad he was dead. And you're a parent. Is that what you want? Is that what you think your dad wanted? You know, your dad was afflicted by this horrible disease that ate him up and had all of his children hating him. And do you need to punish anybody more than that? Is that really necessary anymore? And what I've really come to learn is that my dad was just a sick alcoholic, and I've learned that by going lots of meetings, of open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and hearing alcoholics share. And, you know, I have been to hundreds, if not thousands, of open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have heard gazillions of AA speakers, and I've ever yet to hear an AA speaker get up to this podium and ever share that he drank and did drugs or did whatever to hurt somebody in his family, ever, that was their intention. And I don't mean to say that I grew up with this dad who hit us and made us feel bad about who we were, and then my sponsor gave me this stupid weenie assignment, and I did it, and then everything was just rainbows and butterflies up the gazoo. You know, that is not what happened to me, because what my sponsor did is she gave me a very precious, precious, precious gift that day, though I didn't realize it at the time. She gave me the gift of forgiveness, and it says in our Al-Anon literature that forgiveness is no favor. We do it for nobody but ourselves. Because, see, I thought if I forgave my dad, I was letting him off the hook. And I was not going to let him off the hook. Because he was the dad. He was the parent. I was the little kid. He was supposed to make me feel special. There's supposed to be father-daughter dances, all kinds of fun stuff going on. Not fear. I'm not supposed to be afraid of my dad. You know, and I wasn't going to let him off the hook. And then again, what I got to learn is that he was just a sick alcoholic. And he paid the ultimate price for that. and it's not necessary for me to punish him anymore. And what I really believe with all my heart is my dad loved me as much as his alcoholism would allow him to. And I know that from going to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and getting to see recovery firsthand, you know, when it gets to happen to families. But anyway, I wasn't easy about it. You know, my dad was cremated, and my dad was a World War II veteran, and he was a Korean War veteran. He had a very distinguished career in both Navy and the Army. I think he did 8 years in the Navy during the war, and then he did 20-something years in the Army. He was well-decorated. I mean, he saved people's lives when he was in Korea, and so they brought me his medals, flag, my dad's ashes, and I happened to be home alone that day, and they dropped that stuff off, and I take my dad's ashes, and I went downstairs, and I stuck them in the laundry room, and I sat him down there in the laundry room, and I put him back behind the washing machine, and I said, and you sit here, and you think about what you did. And he sat there for a frigging long time, let me tell you, boy. Every time I go downstairs, okay, Sarge, who's in charge now? Sarge, you know. And every so often I'd pick up that box and shake the crap out of it and do whatever. All sponsor approved, let me tell you, you know, because it's a process here, okay? We talk about it, but it's definitely a process. When I was 17, I met my husband. Up until this point, we'd always lived in military housing. We'd always lived on the East Coast and in Europe. And so when I was a teenager, my dad got out of the Army. We moved to Southern California. And us girls are getting old now, and we're starting to date. And it's really hard to date in my house because my dad's got a lot of rules and regulations about dating. And we bring these little weenie guys home. And my dad, you know, like I said, he's over 6 foot tall, an ex-master sergeant. He's got one eyebrow he can raise like 6 inches over this one side of his forehead. He looks like the devil himself standing there. And he would drill these little weenie guys where they were going, what time we had to be back, and what part of their anatomy he would remove if we were not returned in the virginal condition of which we left the house in the first place. So it's really hard to get a second date in my house, like almost impossible. I mean, some guys, you wouldn't even be gone 30 minutes. They'd just be so freaked out by it, bring you home. Goodbye, thank you, nobody's worth this, you know, and off they would go. And, you know, and that's the way I remember until my sister reminded me, yeah, Dad's intimidating, but the fact that he always had a sidearm or a hand grenade never helped either, you know. And he always did. He's always packing a gun, always a hand grenade. He was always going to blow up the neighbors or the mailman or somebody because that's the alcoholic, you know, grandiose stuff that was always going on. And that's why I have no qualms as the non-drinker how we get so sick, too, behind that behavior because I grew up with that behavior every single day. And I got to make some kind of sense out of it. You know, in our literature where it says every good sense tells you there's something wrong with the alcoholic's drinking and thinking, but you still hide what you know and how you feel. Every good sense tells me, but I got to rationalize and justify why it's okay so that I can be in this house. I have to rationalize and justify so when the kids in the neighborhood say stuff about my drunk dad and my dad's very violent behavior when he is drunk, I'm the one that's got to get in a fight with them and defend the honor of the family and all that stuff. And I got to rationalize and make it be all okay. And that's how I am affected by the family disease of alcoholism. Anyway, when I was 17, I met my husband. I should have known there was something wrong with him because my dad liked him right away. And that, like, had never, ever, ever happened before. And I remember going on this first date with him, and I was 17, and he was like 23, 24. He'd been married once before, had a kid, should have been clue number two to me that there was something wrong with him, but that went right over my head. And so we went on this bowling date, and after that, we were going to go back to his place and with this other couple that we were with, and he stopped at a liquor store, and he asked me what I wanted to drink. Well, I'm a rule and regulation person, you know, and I mean, so, and I am, you know, I am not a legal age to drink, so I start to tell him the rules and regulations of the state of California and the drinking laws, you know, and I know he heard what he still hears today when he doesn't want to hear what I'm saying. He heard blah, 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 because he went in and got a gallon of Red Mountain wine to, I guess, impress me about wine, because I don't know nothing about it anyway. And so we go back to his house, and we're going to play this game. It's a legitimate game. It's called Pass Out. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of it or not, but you can get it on eBay. And so I'd never heard of it before, but it had rules. I read them all, because I'm a winner. And now I am 17. I don't drink. I've told you, you know, growing up with this dad, what I know is keep your nose clean, boy. follow orders, straight A's in schools, do not rock the boat, do not upset the Sarge. And this is what I've been doing. And now I go out with this guy, now up until this point, I've only, you know, dated straight A students like myself, geeky little dudes. And here's Butch, he's like 7 years older than I am, he's a hippie guy, he's got a long beard, long hair, tattoos, no underwear, another clue they're an alcoholic. And you know it's true, so don't even go there with me after this. And, I mean, it should be in the Al-Anon literature for sure, but just, that's just a, oh. And I don't drink. But anyway, but we're going to play this game, and it's a drinking game. You know, now I have a lot of rules and regulations. I just do, you know. And one of my big rules is I have to play every game, you know, I have to win every game I play. It's just the way it is, because that's the way I was raised. Boy, in Sergeant's house, boy, you do not lose. You do not surrender. And I don't care if you have to cheat to win, you do it, you know. That's just the way it goes down. You will come up victorious. And so I don't drink, but now I'm going to play this game with him, so now I got to shift my rules around. So I don't know, I just drank a little bit of this wine, first thing I've ever drank in my life, and of course it was god-awful. And I didn't have a half a cup of that crap, and I won the game, because that was that's all about. But guess who drank all the rest of that wine? And I'll tell you what I remember about that night still to this day is what a wonderful time I had. I had such a good time, so much fun, so much laughter. Just this easygoing guy, so much, I hadn't been exposed to anything like that ever in my life. But believe you me, I've got an index card in my head about what my life is going to be, and I got a lot of rules and regulations. I can't wait to get out of that house. You can cut the hate in my house with a knife. I just want out of there so bad I can't even tell you. And I'm going to marry somebody, and he's going to love me, and he's not going to drink, and we're going to have like 12 girl children, and he's just going to be thrilled about being a dad to 12 girls, and it's just going to be a whole different deal. But on that card, too, is he's not going to drink. Now I'm going out with this guy, and I'm having so much fun. And, God, he's drank a lot. He is definitely drunk. There is no doubt about it. But, again, I, the sick person, will rationalize and justify, I, the non-alcoholic, to get what I want how I want it. And, again, information from nowhere lands here, becomes fact for me. Because I tell you how I got to that answer, it's really simple. Where my dad drinks, and he wants to hit you and yell at you and make you feel bad about yourself, when my husband Butch drinks, he just wants to love you and kiss you and tell you how pretty you are. And I can work with that, okay? That's got potential written all over it for me, okay? We're doing the deal here, buddy. And so we pretty much started dating exclusively from that point on. Really hard for me to date Butch. Why? Because he couldn't remember my name. That's why. I mean, you know, I know it's weird and it's different. And he'd call me up all the time, Lorraine, Lucerne. He'd call me all kinds of crap. But he knows my name really well now, finally. But I just, whatever, we're going. And of course, all the drinking and all that stuff was going on. And my name is different. And it's weird. It's Larcine. My dad named me Larcine, and like I said, my dad was not happy about having girl kids, not happy about it at all. But because I was firstborn, my dad gave me this name Larcine because my dad was hugely proud. I can't even tell you how proud my dad was of his Scottish heritage. And he told me that Larcine was the name of a town in Scotland. And since he couldn't name me after him, that he was going to give me this really special name and that I should always, always be proud of it because it's the name of a town in Scotland. And so I've been hearing that since one of the very first stories I ever heard in my life. And I've always been proud of it. Now my dad's dead. I'm in Al-Anon for a while. Again, before Google and computers, when you wanted information, you had to go to a building called a library. That's where they had information. And I went to the library to look up Larcine, Scotland, and I could not find it. So I went to the reference librarian, and I asked her to look it up for me. And she said, well, come back in a couple of weeks. We'll send it to the big downtown library, and, you know, we'll have the information for you. So I come back in 2 weeks, and guess what? No Larcine, Scotland. It doesn't exist. Okay, I've just gone through this big frickin' surrender and forgiveness of my dad, you know, and one more time, here's my dad nicking me from the freaking grave, the butthead, and, you know, because I'm right back to it, and I'm getting nuts about it, and I have a friend that goes to Scotland, he's a big golfer, I guess Scotland's like the golf mecca of the universe or something, he goes, you know, there isn't Larcine, Scotland now, maybe there was Larcine, Scotland like thousands of years ago, it's an old country, I got a lot of friends in Scotland, let me check it out before you go bananas on us, and so he goes off to Scotland, he comes back 2 weeks later, talk to everybody in Scotland, never been Larcine, Scotland. Now I'm going to change my name, bite me dad, you know, and I mean, I'm just pissed. And I happened to be with my husband at his AA meeting, and this friend of ours walks up to me, and he goes, Larcine, you're not going to believe it, but I found out that Larcine is a Scottish word. And I'm like, oh my God, you're kidding me. What does it mean? He goes, it is Scottish, for father was drunk, and so daughter got a weird name. That's what it means in Scottish. And I'm pretty sure that that is not true, okay? But what he went on to tell me, is, you know, Larcine, I'm alcoholic like your dad is alcoholic. He goes, and I don't know what he was doing or what happened or if he read something wrong or wrote it down wrong. He goes, but I'm here to tell you that I believe that your dad believed that Larcine was the name of a town in Scotland. You know, and just because it's not wrapped the way that you want it to be, does it make it any less of a gift? You know, and one more time, you know, I bring something to you guys. Attitude is everything here. I bring something to you guys, and you just show me a different way to look at it. Because in reality, my circumstances have not changed. My name does not mean a bloody thing. It really and truly doesn't. But I take it to you, and you show me a different way to look at it, and it means everything to me now. It means everything to me now. And I have personalized license plates, and it's Larcine, because I got 7 letters, so it's Larcine. So about a year ago, my husband got me license plate holders that say, it's the name of a town in Scotland. And they're on my car right now in my driveway, so... And I keep thinking, poor people see that driving down the street. I hope they never get on Jeopardy and answer that because they're going to be wrong. But anyway, Butch and I started dating. It was, like I say, hard to date him. And we dated for a couple of years. And there's a lot of drinking, a lot of drug use, a lot of stuff going on there. My husband never hid any of that stuff from me. He was an always in-your-face kind of a guy. This is what I'm doing. There was no pretending or anything else like that. But never anything I felt I couldn't work with or do whatever. You know, I love him. You know, and I'm here to tell you, if loving could fix alcoholics, not a one of us that have to be in AA or Al-Anon, I'm here to tell you. You know, it's just the way, it seems like that, but love is the answer. It really and truly is, but just loving them can't fix them. And what ended up happening is after a couple of years of dating, I got pregnant. Doesn't matter if it's a big deal for you, it's a huge deal for me. It's 1972. You know, I'm 19 years old. After Butch and I got married a couple of months after our son was born, and our life got really, really bad, really, really bad behind his drinking and drug use. And I thought because I'd broken this big rule and big regulation that it was God punishing us, you know, or God punishing me specifically. You know, and what I've come to learn here is that the God in here is so big and so wonderful, and he really doesn't care where you've been or what your past is or any of that stuff, AA or Al-Anon. You know, all he cares, you know, is about what you're doing now. Be of maximum service to God and your fellows. I think it says in the big book that God's, you know, that you know, you want to know what his will is for us? His will is for us to be happy, joyous, and free. That's it, no more, no less. That's what he wants for every single person, I think, that walks the face of the planet. I hear people all the time say, but for the grace of God. You know, I think, but it's for the acceptance of God's grace, because I think God's grace is there for every single person. Just whether or not you're willing to accept it, or do you want to fight it over and over and over again? Who stands in the way? If it's God's will for me to be happy, joyous, and free, what do I do to carry out God's will then? You know, living in the past, being angry, striking out, trying to get even, whose fault is it? You know, all of those things keep me from living in the present and enjoying and being happy, joyous, and free, because that's really where it is all the time for me. But anyway, Butch and I ended up getting married a couple of months after our son was born, so if you ask me if I was pregnant when I got married, no, I wasn't. I wasn't. You figure it out. That's your job, not mine. But I'm here to tell you, you know, up until that point, I'd never discussed with Butch his drinking or his drug use, but the day after we got married, I sat him in the kitchen chair and I told him the rules and regulations of the marriage, you know, and there'd be none of this drinking and partying all the time. Once a month we would get a babysitter and that was it. Do you understand? He sat in the chair and he did this, which I took as affirmative. What I know today, he was just so drunk and so loaded, he was just doing this thing. And he heard the blah, 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 blah part. And I know this because why? Day 3 of our marriage, he does not come home all night long. This is a huge violation of the rules and regulations I have sat down. And I am here to tell you, I watched my mom do the silent treatment. I know that didn't work. I am proud to stand before you and tell you Butch begged for the silent treatment. He begged for it. And he never got it, not one time. I was like one of those little dogs when you walk in the room, just and curse. I don't even know. Again, information from nowhere lands here, becomes fact for me, because I am sure if I curse with the right mothers and effers in the right order that he's going to have some spiritual awakening, you know, and stop all that behavior right then and there. And just the absolute craziness. Now, I positively want you to know the reason that Butch and I got married was the fact that we had this little boy. There is no doubt about that. But I also want you to know that when Butch and I got married, we got married in a church in front of a minister, that he was sober that day, that I loved him and I believed he loved me, and that we were as sincere as any two people are when they're getting married. We wanted to love each other, take care of each other, cherish each other, do all of those things. But he didn't know, and what I didn't know was it wasn't just Butch and Larsine that got married that day. It was also the family disease of alcoholism. And I'm here to tell you the family disease of alcoholism doesn't love or cherish anything or anybody. It means to tear your family apart, and it will do so through the alcoholic, but it will do so equally through the non-drinker in the family. That's the family disease of alcoholism. You know, so this marriage just took off like old gangbusters, just total insane gangbusters. And, you know, and him drinking and using and doing all that stuff, and me doing everything in my power to stop him from doing it. Everything in my power. You know, and for the most part, he's a pretty easygoing guy. He just, you know, all he wanted to do was get drunk, lay down, and pass out. I shared that once a very long time ago, and an old friend who's long since gone to the big meeting, this guy, Hank Johnson, was sitting next to Butch. And he leaned over to Butch and said, "Butch, I don't think that's too much to ask for." And, but it was more than I could give him, that's for sure. And, because, boy, I just wasn't going to have it happen to me. No, I can't do this. You know, I had all the, you know, all that growing up, and that this is not going to happen. This is not going to happen. And I did everything in my power to stop my husband from drinking. You know, there is no end to all the crap that goes on. And you know, and if Butch were, you know, you talk to Butch and you ask him to describe his drinking, his word is pig. That's his word, not mine. But to give you an example of that, one day I'm at home with our son. I get this call from these drug dealers, you know, and these are just drug dealer people, and he is over at their house, and he is so drunk and so loaded that if I do not come get him, they, the drug dealers, are going to call the police. This is what's going on in my life. And so I put on my cape and off I go to rescue him, as I often do. And I remember getting to the drug dealer's house and them looking through the Venetian blinds to see if I'm there. Because he's out of the drug dealer's house. He's in the bushes. They've thrown him out of the house. He's in the drug dealer's bushes. And I get him out of the bushes, and I get him in the car, and I drive home. And I go to put our son in his crib, and I come down to get Butch, and he's fallen in the street. And he's cracked his head open, and blood is gushing out all over. And I like to tell you how concerned I am about him, but I am not. You know, I just want to get him in the house before anybody sees him. And he's 180 pounds of wet washcloth. I can't pick him up. So I got him by the ankles, and I heave him up over the curb, drag him down the sidewalk, little trickle of blood, leaving a trail right behind him. Now, why we call these people normies, I have not a clue. But here I am dragging a guy bleeding by the head down the sidewalk. It's like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And this guy's driving down the street, and he stops the car and says, "Are you having a problem?" "Yeah, I am." I go, "My husband's fallen, and he can't get up." And so, of course, he helps me get him up, and we get him in the house, and now the words are flying between him and I. And again, you know, I just got this emergency head. What do I have to do? He's got a head injury. I have to get him in bed because it goes on my rule card. And once it goes on my rule card, it's got to happen. So not only do I have to get him in the house, I have to get him up a flight of stairs into bed, because that's where you go when you cracked your head on a curb, according to information from nowhere, which lands here, and that's what I function on. And so now as we're going up the stairs, you know, he and I are just cursing at each other, and Mr. Good Samaritan no longer wishes to participate. And so that guy was out of the house like a shot. Now here's Butch on the bed, big puddle of blood. Now I want my husband to die desperately. I do. People once said to me, "Why didn't you just divorce him and let him win?" "Oh, I don't think so. It's not going to happen that way." No. He's dying. That's how it's going to go down. You know, works for me. I'm a widow. You feel sorry for me. He's out of my life. It's a perfect answer. And But you know, I want him to die, but I don't want my fingerprints anywhere on it when it happens. So I, you know, now I don't know what to do. And there is a big puddle of blood. So I call 911. I'm hysterical. Hook and ladder truck, paramedics, police. They even get a hold of my mother, you know. And so the paramedics are cleaning them all up. I'm in the bedroom with the baby crying. Oh, my husband. The police come in and they go, Mrs. Gantner, your husband says he injured himself because you pushed him down a flight of stairs. And, of course, more drama, more drama. No, I didn't push him down, officer, but if you'll prop him up, I'll be happy to push him down in front of the Redondo Beach police. Let's just keep on going. And so they know you don't need to do that. And they clean him all up, and he's got some little weenie cut, and he needs like 5 stitches, but he's so drunk, they got to take him by ambulance to the hospital because he can't even stand up. Now, I don't know how your neighborhood is, but 5 o'clock, hook and ladder truck, paramedics, all my neighbors are out front, and Butch is a friendly guy. He always has been. He knows all the neighbors. I speak to no one because I am huge on anonymity. And I mean, I don't speak to no one. And so out comes Butch on the gurney. Hiya, Frank. Hiya, Joe. You know, his usual happy self. And there, Butch, what happened? Larsine pushed me down a flight of stairs. And every single frickin' person believes that that is exactly what happened. Because all they ever see is drunk, easygoing Butch and screaming Banshee Larsine. Because for whatever reason, I never ever figure out that they can hear me cursing and screaming halfway down the block because the door is shut. You know, and that's the insanity of the family disease of alcoholism, and I know no better way than to describe it. I have no idea, because I'm the good guy. I'm the good guy in this whole situation. You know, and one time we were going to we have this family reunion. It was his family reunion. He's 1 of 9. I make him raise his right hand, promise me he'll be sober that day. He does, because he means to be. You know, because I don't know my husband's alcoholic. I have no idea about this. Because, again, I have information from nowhere. Lands here becomes fact for me. Because, see, what happens is if there's a drink, I can drink it or not drink it. So that means you can drink it or not drink it. So that means you're drinking at me and you're trying to hurt me. And so all I know is when I get hurt and I get hurt and I get hurt, because you promise me over and over and over again you're not going to do it anymore, then all I want to do is hurt you back. When every good sense will tell me, just let it go and let it be over. Because that's the insidiousness of the disease of alcoholism. And I'm here to tell you, no matter how many horrible things or bad things you think my husband's done, he did everything under the influence of drugs and alcohol. Every hurtful, spiteful word that ever came out of my mouth came out stone cold sober, with the intent of hurting him. And I think I'm the good guy in the situation. That's how devastating the family disease of alcoholism to the family members. Just my experience. But anyway, we're going to have this family reunion. He raises his right hand. And guess who's so drunk that day? So drunk he can't even stand up. And I am livid. Livid. And I remember poking him in the chest. And I'm here to tell you, no matter how drunk or blacked out my husband's been, he's never, ever raised a hand to hit me, because that's just not, he's just not violent that way. But that day I was poking him in the chest, egging him to hit me. Let's just take it to the next level. Let's just take it there. And I remember all of a sudden looking down, and by then we had 2 little boys, and they're like, you know, 5 and 3 years old, and they were standing on either side of me, yanking at my pant legs. Mommy, mommy, please stop yelling at daddy. And I would like to tell you that I had a moment of clarity then, but I did not. What I started doing was I started screaming at those little boys, how dare they tell me to stop yelling at their dad when he's the reason our life is the piece of crap that it is. And by the time I got done screaming at these little boys, I watched my drunken husband walk out the front door, and I, the sober mom, say to the drunken dad, where do you think you're going? And the drunken dad turns to the sober mom and says, I'm leaving because we're upsetting the kids. And I'll tell you this story because I'm proud of it. I tell you because this is where the disease of alcoholism took me, and I think I'm the good guy. I'm so justified. I always tell people, you know, justifiable anger is just as deadly to the Al-Anon as the first drink is to the alcoholic. I will run with that. I will make everybody's life as miserable as I can because my life is so miserable behind it. And, you know, and somewhere in all that, I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and I'd gone to school with this girl, and her dad had gotten sober, and Crazy Jean, and he remember him taking me to this meeting and sitting in the front row and you know, and seeing all this stupid literature, you know, merry-go-rounds about denial and all other kinds of crap like that, you know. And again, one more time, you know, but when I was sitting in that front row, if they would have said, Larsine, do you want your life to be different? Oh, my God, do I want my life to be different? Larsine, what are you willing to do about it? Nothing, because it's not my fault. Not my fault. You fix him, I'll be okay. And I really believe that with every fiber of my being, because I don't know that happiness is an inside job. I have absolutely no idea of that. And that's why I can never be happy, because I'm always looking for outside things to make me happy. Never knowing that the real secret lies within, just being okay with who you are right here, right now. Good enough for God. Good enough for God. And but anyway, so that was like my Al-Anon career, and then we just went back to all the insanity, and somewhere a little bit after that, another year or so, my husband ended up getting sober, you know, and he got arrested for drunk driving, which is no big deal. He's been arrested a ton of times for drunk driving. You know why this is the one that got him sober? His last drunk, I wouldn't even give a five, you know, but that's the one he freaking, go figure. That's alcoholics. Don't even try and figure them out. It will drive you insane. But he got sober, and so, you know, he's going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got sober in 19, I started coming in, he got sober 2 years ahead in 1979, you know, and in 79, they didn't know family, nothing. They said I should go to a Al-Anon meeting, and I'm a rule follower, so I went to a Al-Anon meeting. I went to that meeting that I just told you I'd been to about a year and a half before. Got in that meeting, and, you know, and they saved the last 10 minutes for newcomers. I raised my hand. I said, I was here about a year and a half ago, and I asked you how to get my husband sober, and you didn't tell me, and I'm not going to tell you how I got him sober now. Because I believe that. Believe you me, I believe that. And you know what those people said to me at that meeting? Keep coming back. You got that right. And I am telling you this because if you're at a meeting and you share something, AA or Al-Anon, I don't care which meeting you're at, and they tell you to keep coming back, it is because you've said the most asinine, ridiculous BS in the entire universe, and that's your only flame and hope, is that you keep coming back, because they can't even help you at this point. That's how bad you are. And just keep coming back. And of course I didn't, you know, and then Butch is sober, and now, you know, and now of course now, and you know how you guys are when you get sober. It's like you go from like, what the heck is this, to ta-da, here we are. You know, we're the best thing in the universe. And it's true. I'm sorry, you ever go to an AA meeting? These are the first AA meetings I go to with Butch. Some Yahoo dude gets up there and he got his driver's license. The place came unfreaking glued, okay? I'm like, I've had a driver's license since I was freaking 16 years old. It's not a big deal. And it's not a big deal in Al-Anon today if you have a driver's license. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, oh my God, you think the guy got a PhD or something. It's incredible to me, you know. Try and figure it out. Don't. Just go, just clap right along. Yeah. I think this is where Jeannie got it from, going to AA meetings. She just learned that, I don't know, but... crazy, just crazy. And again, I would go with Butch. They would always make me feel welcome. They always made me feel loved. They always made me feel a part of. But you fix him and I'll be okay. And what ended up happening was 2 years into that whole deal, I was anything but okay. And nobody was more shocked than me, because I was sure that his sobriety would fix me. When he's a good husband, when he's a good father, when he brings home a regular paycheck, you know, when he does all those things, they'll make me well. And what happened, he was beyond any expectation I had, because he was going to Alcoholics Anonymous and he was working a program. And the most important thing of all is he was bringing that thing home. He was bringing that program home, working it in our house, regardless of my behavior. You know, and all I did was get angrier and angrier and angrier at it. Nobody was more shocked than me about that whole thing. And I remember one time, now our boys are bigger, and him and the boys are in the living room, and they're laughing and cutting up. And I'm walking through, because I'm a task-oriented person, you know, there is no fun till the job is done is my motto. And I'm walking through the living room with my laundry basket, and as I set foot in the living room, there's just dead silence. Because that's what I do now. I suck the joy out of the room. That's my gift to this family. And I remember walking through that room, and I heard God's voice in my head as clear as a bell. And he said, you become your dad. And that's exactly what was going on, because my fear of, if I don't ride you hard, if I don't watch everything you're doing, I can't give you so much as an inch, because you're going to hurt me again. You'll drink again. This will go on again. Now I got to watch these boys just as much as I ever had to watch you. You know, and it's all fear. You know, and what I've learned from my sponsor is, you know, what fear really stands for, and it's not what you guys are thinking, it's forgetting everything's all right. Because right here, right now, everything is all right. I can think about the things I think may or may not happen. It doesn't matter. But in this moment, is it all okay? Then why are you giving it up? Why are you giving up precious time about the fear of what you think may or may not happen? And so anyway, so... After my husband was, 2 years sober, I started coming to Al-Anon because, just for that reason, it was like I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired. I didn't come to get an alcoholic sober. He was sober on his own, didn't come to keep him. He was doing fine on his own. I came because I was sick. And I got a sponsor right away, and I did the literature. And I remember the first time I used my sponsor as a sponsor, my husband had a dead battery, and he asked me to jump it, and I did. And then he ran out of gas, and this pissed him off. So he started yelling and screaming. You know how you guys overreact to every little thing. I started yelling and screaming. When you start yelling and screaming, I start yelling and screaming. He went off to work, and I went upstairs. I called my sponsor and reported his behavior because he was bad. And I remember getting done telling her what had happened. And when I was done telling her what he did, she told me I owed him an amends because what I said was unkind and unnecessary. And I'm like, whoa, 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 Jeannie doesn't know how we do things in America, because she was from Holland. And so I started telling her the story again, because she was not listening to the who started it part, which I always think is so important. And I didn't even get barely started when she stopped, stopped me cold and said, I heard you the first time. And for what you said, it's unkind and unnecessary. You owe your husband an amends. And another thing, don't ever call me and start a conversation with Butch said or Butch did. I don't care what he did. All I know is I am Larstein's sponsor. And all I care is about what you said and you did. Because of what you said and you did, you owe your husband an amends. I'll see you at the meeting tonight. Click end of conversations. I learned valuable lessons. Never call your sponsor first thing in the morning because you got all day long to think about what she told you to do. And I got to do it because I'm a rule follower, And I don't know how Butch came in the door that night, 5, 6 o'clock. I don't put nothing off, boy. I marched right up to him and I said, I'm sorry I let your shitty attitude affect me the way that it did. And I'll try and do better in the future. Now, that may not sound like the best amends you ever heard, but I am here to tell you to this day, I don't know that I've ever made a better amends in my life, ever. Because that day I was this much willing to take some sponsor direction to go against everything I ever believed in, to take the shot at a good life. And that's just and from that day to this day, this much every day, I have a sponsor and a home group, I work the steps, I be of service, and every day I get this much time, I can get the shot at a good life, if I so choose to take it. The tools are laid at my feet every single day. I have a sponsor who's a personal rooting section for me. She wants me to do well here. She does nothing but encourage me to do well. So I get the shot at a good life if I so choose to take it. And that's been the gift. After Jeannie died, I got my sponsor, Carol. And Carol always insists that I tell this story because she wants you to know how sick I am and what a difficult job I am as a sponsee. And so I honor her with our youngest son, Earl, had a lot of problems with drugs and alcohol. And I was maybe 15 years in Al-Anon, and he was like 19 years old. And what's the worst that can happen? They can die. It's very terrifying, especially the kids. It's just a really scary deal. And I was having a lot of difficulties with him and very worried about him. And we'd been at our roundup that Butch and I are very active in. And so, and it was a great weekend and great speakers, workshops. And, you come home from the weekend and, like, serenity is coming out of every orifice of your body, just full of all the love and the joy and all that stuff. And Sunday we get home from the roundup, and I'm very disciplined in my exercise. I haven't exercised in 3 days. That means I got, like, 72 hours of exercise. I got to check off so I can check off my list. So as soon as I get home, I get on my exercise stuff, and I had a treadmill in the garage, and I go out there to go exercise, and next to my treadmill is my son's weight bench, and on this weight bench is a driver's license, and it's a woman's driver's license. It has information. I love information. She lives in Glendora, California. Her birth date's on there. She's 32 years old. I instantly decide in 10 seconds or less, information from nowhere lands here, that she has been in my house. She has had sex with my 19-year-old son. She has 2 kids. She wants to marry him and call me mom. I am all over this story. And I run into the house, and I show Butch the driver's license and nothing, because the man has no imagination whatsoever. So I tell him what I think happened over the weekend, and his eyes roll back in his head, and he's like, call Carol, you are wacky. So I call Carol, and Carol rarely gives me direction, but that day she told me to shut up. Just shut up. She goes, I know you are scared for this kid. I know you are. She says, but Larstein, it takes just as much effort to send good thoughts his way, prayers his way, than to think negative stuff about him. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Nobody has any idea what's going to happen. But why don't you think good thoughts for that kid instead of negative ones? He's got enough stuff going on without you adding more crap to it. And again, I end my conversation, because I've been coming for a while, never mind. You know, and then as it turns out, I don't see him for a couple of days because his drug and school schedule and my work schedule. And he comes in, and then he has the driver's license in his hands. He says, Mom, what do you do when you find a driver's license? Well, I do not tell him what I do when I find a driver's license. Because it's a bad example of somebody who's going to meetings, working the steps, spiritual person, blah, blah, blah. You know, and one more time, left to my own devices, people keep going, why do you keep coming to Al-Anon? 10 seconds alone in the garage to this day still keeps me coming to Al-Anon. Why? Because I am hardwired to think badly. I am just hardwired to do that. I have learned to throw that first thought out the window. But I bring it to you. The circumstances don't change. You just show me a different way to look at it, and I get the shot at a good life. And that happens over and over and over again. You know, I had a real hard time with God when I got here. I wasn't raised with any kind of religion at all. My dad was, as far as he was concerned, he was the sperm of the devil, and we were his spermettes. We're all going to hell. I mean, and that's the way I was always raised with that. What kind of a God lets people have? What kind of a God lets people die? What kind of a God does that to little children? Let's an alcoholic dad be there. Who does that? Who can believe in any of that? I used to have so many issues with God, and I remember my meeting one night, and I've been going to this meeting for about a year, trying to do the steps, but I could never get past the God stuff. And my friend Crazy Jean, that night, and it was a step study meeting, and they stick to the step. Boy, you're on the step, that's the step you do. But that night, every single person in that room shared about finding a higher power in the program of Al-Anon. And they shared it for my benefit, specifically for my benefit. And at the end of that meeting, after we said the Lord's Prayer, you know, then Jean said to me, Larsine, did that help you? Did you find a God, you know, put you on the path to find a God of your understanding? You know, but I don't want to do what I don't want to do. And I told Gene, well, I appreciate it, but it ain't going to happen for me. It's just never going to happen for me. And I remember Gene saying to me, you know, Larsine, why God gave you ears? And Gene's kind of a mean guy, and so I sarcastically said back to him, I know, so I can hear what you're trying to tell me. He goes, well, in most people's cases, that's true, but in your case, God gave you ears so you'd have something to hold on to while you yank your head out of your ass. So that night I went home and I went in my backyard, you know, and I looked up to God and I said, God, Larsine Gantner, gave him my address and my phone number, because I mean, he didn't know me and I don't know him. And that's the prayer I just said. And I don't know you. But Gene, who I do know and who I do believe has my best interest at heart, tells me I have to find you or I'm not going to get the shot at a good life. And this much at a time, every single solitary day. And now God goes with me everywhere I go, all the time, over and over and over again. About a couple of years ago, that son that was 17 years old, he was 37 years old, and he came to his dad and said that he had a problem with drinking. And his dad gave him a big book and some numbers to call. And I'm happy to tell you, my son has about 18 months of sobriety right now at... And I can't tell you what a gift that is, and how grateful I am. But I want to sit here and talk specifically to the people who don't get that gift. I've had a sister die from the disease of alcoholism. I've had a dad die from the disease of alcoholism. I had a husband get sober and a son get sober. You know, and I can't believe in a God that lets my son get sober, but your son not. And again, one more time, what I've really come to believe is, sobriety is not our gift to give. Again, if loving them would fix them, not a one of us would have to be in this room. But what God gives us is just the grace to accept, you know, the program as it's presented to itself. Everybody gets that chance. And it's whether or not that they want to take it or they don't want to take it. But it's their life to live. And what I am the most grateful for about my son's sobriety, because, I mean, this has been a long road with him. He was 37 years old, but I'll tell you what I learned in Al-Anon that I am the most grateful for, and that is unconditional love. My sponsor, Jeannie, made me look up unconditional, and that means there's no freaking conditions. That's it. It's unconditional. And that means there's not a thing you can do that can make me not love you, but unacceptable behavior is unacceptable behavior, and I have a right to be happy, joyous, and free. But because you drink or whatever, I know you're not drinking at me. And so I got to love that kid unconditionally, and he knew he was always, as long as he was sober, was welcome in our home. And maybe he wouldn't stay for very long, and sometimes he didn't show up at all. But he knew that he was loved by his mom and his dad no matter what. You know, and I just want you to think about, you know, if I'd gotten my wish and my husband had died like I wanted him to, I want you to think about what kind of a family, even though the alcoholic is out of the picture, you know, and this would be like, you know, 33 years ago. And then I want you to think if my husband had died and I'd gotten my wish, and I want you to think about that angry woman and those two little kids, and I want you to think about what kind of family we would be to now without the alcoholic. I can't even imagine the horror that would be going on because of all the anger that this person had passing on to those kids. The family disease of alcoholism doesn't care who it hurts. But here, you know, with each other, we get to love each other, you know, and we get a shot at a good life. And I certainly hope with all my heart that you guys hang on and take that shot at a good life because you deserve it. You know, and I don't know how to say thank you, but, you know, I came to a room full of strangers and I learned how to love my own family. I have a little candle that I keep in my kitchen. It says a candle loses nothing of its light by lighting another candle. I want to thank you guys from the bottom of my heart for lighting my candle. Thanks for having me.